Hello and welcome to Pembrokeshire Local, the show that will bring you closer to the places before you get there. We will try to give you a flavour or an aperitif of Pembrokeshire's finest attractions, whether they be well known or some new ones trying to get on the tourist trail. We start with an island, a very small one, but a very important one, with an amazing past and hopefully a fantastic future. St Catherine's Island, accessible from Castle Beach in Tenby, only at low tide though. I spent the morning there with unrestricted access. I spoke to Rosemary and Andy, the tour guides, and Graham Fry, the island's current owner, and it was an amazing day. So good morning from Castle Beach in Tenby. We are walking on the sand towards St Catherine's Island. So I'm just walking towards Catherine's Island with Andy. What is your job description, Andy?
I basically run the tourist side of things on St Catherine's Island. So yeah, it's a brilliant job.
Are you here every day?
Pretty much every day, depends on the weather, depends. What we say is wave, weather, wind and walk up.
Right, and obviously very tidal related.
Yeah, so 6 hours a day, the island is underwater, as it were, or swamped.
Yeah.
6 hours a day, we've got, so it basically is 12 hours a day, it's every 6 hours
okay.
that we're cut off.
How many steps are there up to the top?
78.
78. You've done it many times.
I've counted them agonisingly every day.
I say, granite steps. It's sort of, the first half of the path is just steps, and then they've sort of made it into a ramp, so it's much easier. And we've reached a little drawbridge. We've reached a bridge. It's a metal bridge. It sort of connects two little bits of the island. There's sort of an arch which the sea goes between. And it's a great view of Tenby here and Coldy Island. I can see the people waiting for the boat to Coldy Island, the first one of the day. It's absolutely beautiful up here. Seagulls are flying around. And I've reached the top. Hello, Rosemary.
Hello.
You're the top guide, I hear.
I'm one of the guides, yes. We're a very small team.
Yes.
But I have a certain amount of knowledge I try to convey to people, make them feel welcome, know what they're dealing with when they come here.
Okay, so I'd like you to convey some of your knowledge to me today.
Well, the first thing people usually ask is, how old is the fort?
Okay.
Thinking that it may be an ancient castle. Actually, it isn't that old. They started building it in 1867. And they finished it in 1870, which is the date over our door. You have to go and stand on our bridge and look high. And then you'll see the initials VR, which is Victoria Regina, Queen Victoria, and the date 1870.
The original building on here was a chapel, is that right?
There's no written record of it that anyone's ever found, but it's a pretty well 99% certainty that it was a chapel. Certainly there was a building. There are early photographs and many pictures that people painted to show it. And people mention the ruins, sometimes visitors to Tenby and they let us home and so on.
Yes.
We would have been actually underneath it if it were still here, because when they built the fort, they cleared the seaward end of the island where we now are and removed a large amount of rock and also the last remains of the chapel.
Right.
So it wasn't properly investigated because sadly there was no time team in those days.
No.
So we've irretrievably lost most of the information we would have had.
But this fort was actually built mainly from the rock of the island?
Not really. It's the same kind of rock that is Carboniferous limestone.
Okay.
But the actual building stone came probably from Lidstep, just down the coast, where there was a large limestone quarry. Possibly from Coldy Island, but I think much more likely Lidstep.
Okay, so Coldy Island was mined as well?
Oh yes. In fact, if you look across at the island at the northward side, it is the left-hand side as you look at it from Tenby, you'll see there is a large quarry there, which you can explore if you're on the island, although you have to be careful because people have fallen trying to scramble around it. But there was quite a big quarrying operation, and there's a cottage on Coldy Island which is still called Quarry Cottage.
Okay. So, and would some of the iron ore from Saunersfoot and that they mined there, and would that have been used in this
place? That's a possibility, but I don't know for certain. It's another angle of research that we'll have to follow up.
Okay. And are you constantly researching this whole thing?
Oh, yes. We have several people who are delving into the history of the island. We have actually corrected a few of our own myths, as it were, that misinformation.
Okay.
We're always trying
to add.
Well, for example, I was told by a guide from an earlier group that They used to have a sign in the front when the place was a zoo in the 1970s, saying lions coming. I don't believe that there were ever lions going to come here. It was a case of lions yesterday, lions tomorrow, but never lions today. Another one going much further back was that they used to say that there was a hermit living on the island. They also used to tell us that it was a princely fortress in the Dark Ages. There's absolutely no evidence for any of that. So we are endeavouring to be as accurate as we possibly can to get rid of the myths, however attractive, and to put solid history in their place. But it can be very elusive.
Yes.
We very often get lost up, as it were, dead ends and have to come back. But we are working on it constantly. And if anyone who visits or who hears about us knows anything about the island from any period, we're always delighted to hear from them.
So really the history of the island is chapel, fort, stately home,
yes,
zoo,
yes,
tourist attraction.
That pretty much sums it up, yes. So for a smallish building, it has a remarkably interesting history.
And what room are we sitting in at the moment?
This, when the place was a fort, would have been the main gun room. So this was in the 1860s, 70s. The guns were actually installed in 1874 to keep off a threatened French attack on Pembroke Dock. So we were actually part of the outer defences of the approaches to Pembroke Dock from the French at a time when a French invasion was feared. It never happened. And the guns never fired. But the main reason for having the fort was to install those guns to fire at French ships.
And the guns fired out of the six windows here?
Yes, they're not actually windows. They look like windows now because we've had glass put in them.
Okay.
But they were originally embrasures, so for the guns to fire through.
Embrasures?
Yes, so the technical word just for a window that a gun fires through.
Okay, so the wind howled in here?
It wouldn't have, in fact, because top and bottom of each window there were enormously thick plates of iron called the iron shields, at which you can still see the remains. They sealed off most of the space, leaving just a gap for the gun to fire through.
Right.
And the iron shields, of course, were to keep French shells out, so that the French couldn't fire shells into the gun room and destroy the guns.
Okay, so I've just been on the roof, and there are gun emplacements pointing out to sea.
Yes.
Is there three, I believe?
There are three, yes, three on the roof, and six in here. But as you can see, the six in here point each direction actually across the bay.
Yes.
And the main aim was to prevent French ships from landing troops on the beaches, particularly South Beach,
right,
which is a mile long and very easy to access.
Yes.
And behind South Beach there are no cliffs, only dunes, which it's very easy to march through.
Yes.
So if French troops got their feet on the ground, they could then march across South Pembrokeshire and attack the dockyard, the naval shipbuilding yard at Pembroke Dock from the rear. So we are here to help prevent that.
Do you think Hitler thought of that too?
It's a possibility because when the fort was sold, put up for sale in 1939, the army actually bought it by compulsory purchase and manned it as a possible watch post. Because, of course, in the early stages of the war, it was feared that the Germans might try landing anywhere.
Yeah.
Nothing ever actually happened here, although we did have an anti-aircraft gun near the fort to fire at any German planes going over.
So that is at the front, isn't
it? That is at the front. You can still see the pegs where the gun was actually secured. I don't think it ever hit anything, but it did its best.
So the three guns at the front, what size of guns were they?
They were what's called a 9-inch RMLs or rifled muzzle loaders. And the ones down here, slightly smaller, they were 7-inch RMLs, so 7-inch rifle muzzle loaders, of a type that almost every fort of that period was equipped with. So at the time, they were the last word. They fired armour-piercing shells, which could pierce the new kind of warship, the Ironclad, which the French had just developed. They were explosive, and the guns that fired these shells were rifled, that is, they had rifling inside the barrel that made the shell much more likely to hit its target, just as you can spin a tennis ball if you're good at tennis and land it just where your opponent doesn't want it. Whereas previous guns were called smoothbore guns, so that's what Nelson had, and they only had ever hit anything through sheer good luck. So we were actually armed with the latest precision weapon at the time.
Almost smart cannons.
Yes, smart cannons at the time, but of course they very rapidly became outdated as the enemy responded by increasing the strength of their armour plating.
Yes.
But our guns were never actually replaced. We rapidly became considered to be an obsolete defence.
Yeah. Where are the guns now?
Alas, nobody knows. When forts like this one were decommissioned, so put out of action by the army early in the 20th century, very often the guns were simply pitched into the sea. And we know that happened in some of the forts around Milford Haven. But what happened to these, we do not know. We've never found them. We would love to find them, and we keep on looking in hope.
Do you think they disappeared sort of in between the fort and the stately home section?
Before that, again, this is something we're still trying to firm up, but there are early 20th century pictures which seem to indicate that many of the guns had already been removed before the fort was actually closed down. Some people say there was only one left on the roof. They would have, by that time, have been entirely useless against any kind of enemy attack and probably would be impossible to fire them. But by the time the place was bought and turned into a stately home, all the equipment had been stripped out.
So I've been downstairs and had a little root around and had a look, and I've been to the gunpowder room. Mm-hmm. Is that the technical word for that?
So the powder room, which sounds like a ladies' lavatory, but is in fact where they kept the gunpowder, which would then be made into charges, that is, put into bags, and those would be rammed into the cannon to serve as the firing charge.
Do you know how many soldiers were sort of commissioned on this fort?
According to most accounts, they weren't actually regular soldiers because the army didn't have enough soldiers to man the forts permanently and also man everything that they had to defend in the whole of the British Empire. And so the people in the forts were almost all volunteers. Right. So they would live locally. There would be one or two probably caretakers living here permanently, but the vast majority of the garrison would be brought in for firing practice or for the emergency, which of course never happened. No. In the full garrison, when they were in full action, seems to have been around 140 men.
Right, okay. So there would be, you know, it's big, but there are, you know, it would be sort of full on in here, wouldn't it? You know, with 140 men sleeping and working at the same time.
So on. Yes, in fact, when you say it's big, compared with most Palmerston forts, particularly those around Portsmouth, our greatest naval base, I say Palmerston forts, that's what they're called after the Prime Minister of the time, this fort was actually tiny. Some of them are absolutely huge, but because we are a fairly minor addition to the equipment of the forts, we weren't that big. But yes, it does appear that in a time of emergency, the gun crews, probably 8 men per gun, would have lived, slept and done everything in this casemate, that is, in the space allocated to their gun, including perhaps even the cooking, because there are fireplaces where it's said that they might have done cooking. Yeah. And they would have been pretty cramped, but of course they probably wouldn't have been here for long at a time.
So from the fort, it then got bought by the MOD and got turned
in. From the fort, it was turned into a house. So it was lived in during the summer as a summer house for a very wealthy family called the Windsor Richards.
Okay.
Then the last of the Windsor Richards to live here, so Lillian Windsor Richards, later her name, Helen Morgan, I think was her name, she put it up for sale. And that's when the army acquired it by compulsory purchase, so just before World War II. Then the army released it after World War II, and it was sold on several times before being bought by the present owners. So it is, in fact, now privately owned.
Did you walk over to Wiseman's Bridge today?
Yes, yeah. Walked Coastal Path and took back, fantastic.
Okay. Tell me about the walk over.
Up and down, so probably, it's a good hour and a half walk.
Fantastic views.
Walk.
Fantastic view.
But a fantastic ride back.
So you've enjoyed your tuk-tuk time?
Oh, fantastic. Yes. It's like being on holidays.
I know.
Yeah,
oh.
And we're glad to come here, and we're nice to see a new form of transport.
The best and only way to experience the Pembrokeshire coastline is from a tuk-tuk time tuk-tuk.
We're sitting here in sort of, I would say, the main living area, wouldn't you, of the Stately Home?
Yes, and more even than the living area, I think this was the area they used to entertain their smart friends. Imagine they, Lillian particularly, the last granddaughter particularly, belonged to a very smart set. Hughes Morgan was the name, correcting myself, the Hughes Morgans. So they owned raced horses, they appeared at all the smartest balls and gatherings. They said they had house parties here, much in the fashion of Agatha Christie, although nobody actually got murdered here for certain. And generally the place was rigged out to look very sumptuous.
Yeah. I can imagine it with all the fireplaces lit, because there must be 10 fireplaces in it.
Yes, and you'd need them, even in summer. Well, it's late spring now and it's extremely cold and damp. So the fireplaces would have helped. The floor was now naked concrete, was then oak blocks, cemented in.
Yeah.
The walls were plastered and then hung with expensive pictures. There were antiques on display, luxurious furniture. There would have been decorations, lavish flower displays, and it would have looked most superb.
Are there any pictures surviving of that?
Sadly, very few, because they were very private, so plebs like me would never have been allowed anywhere near the place. We do have one picture from the mid-1930s of this hall, lavishly decorated mostly with hunting trophies. They obviously went on elaborate expeditions. So it's said that when you came in at that time, you were greeted by a polar bear skin being used as a rug, and its blue glass eyes would glare up at you from the floor, which strikes me as fairly horrific, but you can actually see that bear skin in the photograph.
I can imagine, actually, and it would be very sumptuous, wouldn't it?
It would, yes. So this really would have been the smart set.
Yeah.
And amazingly, apparently, everything was packed away for the winter, including all the paintings, which were taken away, and some of them were twice the height of a man.
Right.
Everything was packed away, no doubt, by legions of servants, and removed from the island, which is no easy task.
Right.
And then the place would be shut up and then reopened again when the family came for their summer holidays.
I noticed there was a gas supply into the house, even in the 1930s.
Yes, in fact, you can see right above where we're sitting, there is a tube which fed the gas to the gas lighting. Again, that must have been extremely expensive to install. They also said had mains water. We do have a bath which has a double set of taps, so that I'm told you could rinse yourself off in bracing salt water and then wash yourself in nice fresh water, hot and cold. What they didn't have was mains electricity, which is just impossible, we've been told, to bring onto the island.
Okay.
So they would operate by generator as we do.
Yeah. So I've been to the generator room and there's like two or three generators in there through history almost, isn't there?
Yes, and we have one which is rather rusting quietly away on our platform, which was used when the fort was being used as a zoo in the 1970s to keep the animals warm, because some of them were from warm climates.
Yeah. From a stately home, it was bought by the MOD.
Yes.
And became an air defence.
An air defence base. Again, we are told it was garrisoned throughout the war by various different detachments. But again, we long to find out more information about what it was like. I did bitterly regret now, of course, that when I was younger, I didn't ask the then older generation in Tenby to talk about it, because
yeah,
there must have been people there who had been in the, or had seen the garrison or talked to them. Although, in fact, my father lived in Tenby throughout the war as a boy and a young man, and what they could do was very restrictive, so there was a certain amount of secretiveness, I think. Mm. Not because the fort was doing anything sinister, but just because of security.
Mm.
So the details may be hard to firm up, but I would beg anyone who hears us, who knows or knows of someone who was here during the war, to get in touch with us if they have any information.
Okay. Hopefully when the podcast goes out, they will, and we'll put a link up. So that moves us on to the zoo, 1968, I believe.
Yes.
Is that right? It seems a very strange place to have a zoo, let's be honest.
It does seem extraordinary, and I think if you tried it nowadays with modern ideas of zoos as spacious places where the animals are as free as possible, they think you are absolutely mad. But in those days, zoo standards were quite different. I think there was much more an air that zoos were for the entertainment of the public, not for the good of the animals. And this space certainly doesn't seem suitable, but then I think anything that brought more trade to the town was and brought perhaps more money into the fort was welcome. And Mr. and Mrs. Batt, who first ran the zoo, were trained zookeepers, and they kept up as high a standard as they possibly could. We know quite a bit about them from their daughter, who still lives locally. She runs the Hedgehog Hospital, so her love for animals has remained. They actually lived on here almost with animals in their bed, as it were.
Okay.
And they cared for them as well as they possibly could.
So what sort of animals did they keep here at the zoo?
Oh, at its zenith, up to 100 different species. The most conspicuous ones were the monkeys. If I've got it right, I think they were actually the kind of monkey that lives on Gibraltar, because they're not actually apes, they're monkeys.
Right.
And they had a fair amount of freedom, and sometimes, according to stories, they actually took more freedom than they were allowed and got loose. So the locals called it Monkey Island.
Right.
They also had lemurs, so the monkey-like creatures that come from Madagascar, who lived upstairs, so on the roof then, and used to have climbing frames and toys that were to amuse them. Then they had a large number of birds, who I presume were mostly pinioned. At one stage it said they had a golden eagle.
Right.
The daughter, Ginny has told us that they had a finch's house at one time, with lots of different kinds of finch. Also that they had a mouse town, which I'll leave her to talk about, because she'll tell you much better than I can.
Okay.
Then on the roof lived the hardier animals, and down here in the gun room, which was the warm section, lived the less hardy ones. They did actually produce a catalogue and guide, of which we have a copy, which anyone can consult in one of our files, which lists a dizzying number of animals from pretty well all the corners of the globe except the polar regions. Although, if you're here on a winter's day, you'd think that polar regions would be just the place for them to come from.
No lions, then?
No elephants. There is a local joke when the people come up and say, did they really have an elephant on here? It would have been quite difficult getting an elephant up the steps, that's for sure. So when they went, the island was more or less abandoned. The fort was shut up. Sadly, this lasted for well over 30 years. Sadly, it was possible for vandals to climb up the rocks. It's dangerous, but it's not impossible.
Yeah.
And they did a lot of damage, not to the fabric, which was too strong to be substantially damaged, but to the interior, which made it very unpleasant to get into, even if you could get in.
Yes. The actual, I think it took about 3 years to build this fort, didn't it, originally?
Yes.
And it's basically all brickwork or stonework, isn't it?
It's mostly solid limestone, yes, limestone blocks. Then they were reinforced by rows of brick, which are visible in some places now that the plaster has fallen off that they installed for the stately home. And then the space around the embrasures, that is the windows where the guns fired through, are actually lined with granite, believed to have come from Lundy Island, which is about 30 miles away as a ship sails. And that was to reinforce, of course, the places most likely to be fired on by the French.
But it's all arches and curves, and it's not straight. Very few straight lines.
No, because the arches, again, if they're quite shallow arches, then they're not delicate and elaborate as you'd find in a high medieval cathedral. But if you go to a very early Norman church and look at the arches there and the immensely thick pillars that maintain the arches, we have something very similar, because that is the strongest shape that you can build, unless you actually build a dome like St. Paul's Cathedral or something, which they obviously weren't aiming at. But this is a tremendously strong building. In 1870, they boasted publicly to the local press, this building is impregnable. There is no way it can be entered by a hostile force. With modern armaments, obviously, you could blow it up in 10 seconds, but in 1870, nobody could get in.
Yeah, the Normans. So we can thank the Normans and the Victorians for an awful lot, can't we?
We have an awful lot to thank both of them for, including the building that we so love to show to visitors.
Yeah, well, it was derelict for 30 years. Not structural damage, but superficial damage. Should we say that?
Superficial, but very difficult to get rid of, in that there appear to have been some furnishings left in parts of the house, parts of the building, which the vandals smashed up. They even managed to smash the metalwork, glasswork. The place was also used as a lavatory. I won't elaborate. It's said, I wasn't here then, but when the fort was first reopened, and that wasn't till 2013, by a small group called the Tenby Island Project, that they couldn't get through the main door. They had to climb in through one of the windows to even start removing the junk. I first saw it more than a year later, and there was still junk piled over my head in the main passageway here.
Yeah.
And I said, by God, what a mess. And they said, you should have seen it when we started.
No.
And of course, they couldn't just throw all the rubbish into the sea. And there's no easy way to get off the island. So they had to trudge down the stairs with loads of rubbish. They then trudged up the stairs with loads of cement, and they began renovation. They did a tremendous job.
How many people have owned the island since the MOD?
Probably three or four. I can't remember the actual details of the people who owned it between the end of the war and the present family acquiring it. But it does appear to have been sold on more than once. Okay.
And who owns it today?
It's a local family. It's actually a family trust. I haven't met them myself, but our leader is in constant touch with them to plan the renovation and ongoing projects for improving the fort.
Do you know what the plans are for the site?
Yes, the most imminent plan, which we hope will be certainly this summer, I hope I'm not putting a hostage to fortune by saying that, is to open some of the rear premises, including the powder room, the gunpowder room, and the shell stores, partly to demonstrate how they were used and partly as exhibition spaces. So that is almost prepared. Then we're going to move down to the only rooms below the present level, which are on what's called the ditch side, where the defensive ditch originally was. That's to be used also as display space. Then a more ambitious project is to make the roof accessible so that people can explore, see where the great guns were, and because it's a fantastic view from there, also perhaps to install a small cafe. That would be my ambition. so that they can enjoy a drink and perhaps a snack and just enjoy being up there. But that is quite an expensive project.
And I believe you get 30,000 people a year plus here?
Certainly, I think we are knocking on 80,000 since we reopened. Obviously, during the lockdown, nobody could come up here at all, so we're only just beginning to build up. But we are looking for thousands, I think, and if we have a sunny summer, then I think we'll have throngs of people all to enjoy the fort.
Tell me a bit about you, Rosemary. What brought you to Tenby?
Well, my grandfather lived here most of his life. He was a master in Greenhill School, which is still going. He eventually mostly senior master and was the chemistry teacher. And so my father was born and brought up here, attended the school and then went to university in Aberystwyth and joined the RAF and eventually became an education officer. But because my grandparents were still living here, we would come here every summer. And because we were in the Air Force and constantly moving from place to place, this was our only settled abode. So we felt anchored here. I say we, Mike, that's my sister and I. Okay. We felt anchored here. So when many, many years later, I finally became able to decide to move down here, I came down here permanently, and I'm staying here now for as long as I live.
What did you study at university?
I studied languages. So the original reason why I contacted Pete, who was then running the fort, so the leader of the Tenby Island project, was that I came up for a visit as soon as I realised it was possible and heard some people speaking French. The guide then couldn't speak French, so I got in touch with Pete and said, would you like somebody who can speak French, German, Spanish to be here in case foreign visitors are, you know, I'll just come round if there are foreigners. And he said, please do come and be a guide anyway. And that's how it started. But if French or Spanish or German visitors come, I can actually talk to them.
Okay. And in the RAF, what was your position in the RAF?
I was never in the RAF myself, and my father was never a pilot. He was education officer, so he was responsible for really upping the education of recruits who perhaps had missed out in school or wanted to raise their level. And so his specialist subject was actually history. So when he left the Air Force, he became a history teacher full time.
Okay, so you've had a full life. This is just icing on the cake, is it?
It is, yes, and it's just lovely to have something to contribute to Tenby, really, after everything that Tenby's given me.
What an amazing day that was. The pictures of the fort and island that I took are now on my Facebook page, Pembrokeshire Local. You can also follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Pembrokeshire Local. So when you're next in Tenby, St Catherine's Island is definitely worth a visit. The entrance fee is currently £5, and good footwear is highly recommended. I hope after listening to this podcast, it enhances your enjoyment of your visit to this iconic and famous island. There is a bonus podcast available to listen to in conjunction with this episode with the current owner, Graham Fry. He speaks to me openly about the past and future of St Catherine's Island. I do hope you enjoyed the show. I'm planning many more. If you have any suggestions as to where I should visit, please get in touch. But for now, thank you.